You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Well, I've had an enjoyable 4th of July vacation, if you will. And because the studio was shut down on the 5th, I did not have a program on the 5th. So it's been 2 weeks since I've recorded a Pronk Pop show. Now, every month, I have at least one segment on the Bureau of Labor Statistics jobs report. And because what happened on the 5th of July, if the studio was open, I would have given this report. In the morning, the Department of Labor releases its jobs report, and it did that Friday. And the unemployment rate stayed the same at 7.6%. But I listened to a number of newscasts and comments about this, and everyone was celebrating the fact that 195,000 jobs were created, according to the non-farm payroll jobs were created. And that's the result from their business establishment survey. The BLS does two surveys every month. One is called the household survey, from which the unemployment rate is determined, where they call on, either over the phone or in person, approximately 60,000 households to determine whether or not you're employed, unemployed, or what they call a discouraged worker, namely, you're unemployed, you're looking for a job, but you hadn't looked for a job in the last 4 months. If you fall in that discouraged category, you're not considered unemployed. Now, personally, you and your friends and your family would all consider yourself unemployed, but the government, starting in 1994 when President Clinton was in office, changed the way they actually calculate the unemployment rate. Prior to that, and for years prior to 1994, you had all your discouraged workers, both short-term and long-term, were included in the unemployment rate. Now, I say that because most people are just not aware of that detail, but it's very, very important because information prior to 1994, we've had unemployment rates usually between 3% and 6 or 7%. Worst case is when you get in a recession or depression. Absolutely the worst case for the United States was during the Great Depression, where the unemployment rate almost went over 25%. It was in March of 1933, which was the worst month, it was at 24.9%. Now, why am I giving you this historical background? You have to, when you hear the numbers, what drives me nuts is a lot of these newscasters just give you the percent and the number of jobs created. They do not relate it to how many people are unemployed, which to me is not really doing your job. So I want to point out, and I'm going to go into, why 195,000 jobs is not really very good. Because to reduce the unemployment rate by just 0.1%, you need at least 300,000 jobs in a month to reduce your unemployment rate by 0.1%. See, what's happened, ladies and gentlemen, is more and more people are becoming discouraged. We have over 2 million people that are in that category. It varies over time. It's been over 3 million unemployed people fit that category prior to this long recession. See, I firmly believe we are not in a recovery. We're still in a recession. Technically, that's not true, because the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a private professional organization of economists, well-respected, I have great respect for their work, has a committee, their business cycle committee, that's responsible for the timing of when a recession begins and when it ends. And it just so happens we're in the fourth anniversary of the so-called ending of the Great Recession, namely in July of 2009. Remember, that's the 6 month, going to the 6 month when President Obama was in office, the economy began to grow again. In other words, it had a positive growth rate, which is good. And to his credit, we've had 4 solid years of positive economic growth. The problem is, historically, United States economy grows around between 3 and 4%. And depending on which decades you use, which is your starting point, your end point, it's on average around 3.3%. Some would say 3.1, 3.2, 3.3. The variance there, or the variability there, is largely due to when you start and when you end. Now, we've had periods of higher growth and lower growth, and again, it depends on which period you're looking at. But historically, this recovery is way below what's happened in previous recessions. This is by far the worst recovery since the Great Depression. We've had, I believe it's 10, I could be off one. We've had 10 recessions since the after World War II. And they typically last anywhere from 6 months to 18 months, some cases 2 years. And remember, the last recession that we were in started in December 2008. And that's when the economy hit its highest point in terms of output, in terms of GDP, or real gross domestic product. And it also happens to be the month prior to that, in November of 2007, we had the highest employment level in the United States, and that, in round numbers, is 146.6 million people were employed. We have not gotten back to that high point, and I'm going to get into a little bit more detail later where we're at. To real simplify it and get your attention, we're over 10 million jobs short of getting not only back to that point, but also 2 points. Not only getting back to the highest unemployment level, but also for all those people in the last 66 months that have entered the labor force to have a job. And just so to put it in context, in November of 2007, we hit a high point in terms of employment of 146.6 million. Now, why the recession ended 4 years ago, in June of 2009, employment tends to lag behind the growth of the economy. We hit bottom in terms of employment level in December of 2009 when the employment level was 138 million. So to summarize, we lost from the peak to the actually low point of employment, 8.6 million jobs. 8.6 million jobs. Now, we have made progress because, like I said, the economy has been growing for the entire time that, no, not the entire time, since July, 4 years ago. So we've had 4 years, which is 16 quarters of economic growth. The problem is the growth rate has been under that historical trend. So from a strictly professional economist point of view, they would say we're in a recovery. And that's true. We have the shorthand definition of a recession is at least 2 consecutive quarters of negative growth in the real GDP, or gross domestic product, which is a total of all final goods and services consumed by the American people. But I want to give you the big picture, because there are literally millions of people out there that are unemployed, and you have different definitions of unemployment. What's called the headline number, or what I call the official unemployment rate, the U3 rate, is at 7.6%. And if you go by that rate, we still have over 11 million, it's closer to 12, 11.7, 11.8 million people unemployed. But that's the low number. What a lot of economists look at, including me, is the U6 total unemployment level, and that is at 14.3. It really jumped from 13.8% up to 14.3%. That's why I say this report was not good. Now, a lot of newscasters were, oh, this is terrific. This was over 20,000 jobs more than what economists were predicting. But remember, to reduce the unemployment rate by just a tenth of a percent, you need to be creating at least 300,000 jobs. Now, why do I say that? That you have a Commissioner Hall of the Department of Labor, and he usually testifies quarterly to the Joint Economic Committee in Congress. And he has been asked this question several times. Mr. Commissioner, how many jobs does the United States need to, the United States economy need to have each month to just keep up with the growth in population? Because every month what you have is people entering the labor force for the first time. He's given answers, typically the one that really summarized it, he would say between 130,000 to 140,000 each month. That's each month. Now, there's a range of estimates. Some economists would say a much lower figure. I've heard as much as low as 100,000. Others would say 150,000 or more. So you're going to get a range of estimates of how many people on average each month that are entering the labor force. And what that is primarily are college as well as high school graduates and dropouts that are looking for their first job. And that's important. It's just to keep even, to keep up, you need to be producing, I think it should be 150,000, but to keep it simple, let's say it's somewhere between 130,000 and 140,000. What I'm leading up to, 66 months ago was November 2007. If you multiply 66 months times, you know, pick whatever estimate you want, 130,000, 135,000, 140,000, 150,000, whatever you want to multiply it by, you're going to see a minimum, just to keep up with population, we need between 7 and 8 million new jobs need to be created in those 66-month period. In addition to that, we needed to create 8.6 million to get back to the previous peak. So the grand total of those two numbers is roughly between 15 million and 16 million jobs needed to be created. Now, what I'm leading up to is, where do we stand today? And I have a number of videos that summarize what happened. But if you go down the very, very first chart, and I have a number, and all this information is taken directly from the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, has a terrific site where you can go and get all this information. I have links to it. But the very first chart that I always show every month is what is the current employment level. And I show it both graphically so you can see. And I start with the year 2000 through June. So, and I need to say this because I'll probably have some listeners out there, you know, well, where do I go to see this? You know, it's very hard to communicate numbers when you're broadcasting. I have a companion blog to this radio show. That's pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, pronkpops.wordpress.com. You put that in, that's the URL or the address of the website. You put that in, click on it, you'll be going to this my site that where I give you some of the information, not all the information. I'm very much selective. I give you a lot of, especially when I'm doing the employment report or the jobs report, I give you a lot of charts, a lot of graphs, a lot of tables, looking at various measures, and one of them is what's the employment level. Well, the employment level was 144,058,000. Let's call it 144.1. Let's round it to keep it simple. Well, a minute ago I informed you that in November of 2007, when we hit the peak in employment in the United States, the highest it's ever been in the United States history was 146.6 million. So just to get back to that level, would require an additional $2.5 million. We're not there. And you can see the graph. We're still below it. Typically, in an economic recovery, first of all, you're growing at economic rates above the trend line, not below the trend line. And remember, the first quarter's growth in the GDP was 1.8%. 1.8%. On average, we're typically around 3.3 is historically a good average. Some will say a little lower. Some will say a little higher. Again, it depends on where you start and end. I'm not quibbling about that. But you can see 1.8 is a lot less than 3.3. And usually when you're in an expansionary period, when the economy is growing and recovering from a recession, you're above the trend line. In other words, you see growth rates of 4, 5, 6, and even 7%. Now, you normally cannot, not normally, you invariably cannot sustain those high rates of economic growth. But when you're coming out of a severe recession, and this is by far a very severe recession, that's what you should be seeing and you're not seeing. And I'll get in a minute as to why. So we're still 2.5 million jobs rounded less than we're at the previous peak. And in addition to that, you had people entering the labor force for 66 months. You multiply, pick, you know, whether you pick 130,000 a month or 140,000 or 150. You multiply that by 66, you'd be somewhere between 7 and 8 million jobs. Add that to the 2.5, we're roughly somewhere between 9 and 12 million jobs short where we should be had we had good economic policies. So I'll be getting into detail on the unemployment report. I wanted to give you kind of the big picture. And I'll really get into why I think this was a terrible report. Even though they might be celebrating in the White House, I would not be celebrating. Because what's happened is more and more, see, people, we have 99 weeks of unemployment. So let's say you were working and then you become unemployed. You have 2 years of unemployment. What happens is people really get serious about looking for a job once their unemployment benefits run out. And for most people, they've run out. I'm not in favor of 99 weeks, by the way. I think 26 weeks is the most. Because there's been studies of this where nations have had even longer periods where you can be on unemployment. And when they've lowered it down, guess what? People suddenly say, hey, I'm not getting my unemployment benefits. I think I won't sit home anymore. I better hustle and get a job. I got rent to pay or mortgage to pay. I need food on the table. I need to take care of my spouse, my children. And I'm not recommending you stay at home, but there's some people that do because we have a welfare state in the United States. You can get food stamps. You can get housing. You can get welfare. And you can get unemployment benefits and Medicaid if you have a medical problem. So that tends to be a disincentive or discourage people from really hustling to find a job. But the problem that this economy that we have right now is many people still are looking for jobs, but they spend weeks, months, in some cases years looking for a job, can't find it. And what invariably happens, they become discouraged. I would be discouraged. Because what happens is you send out resume after resume or fill out application after application. In many cases, especially in this environment, you'll have dozens of people applying for just one opening. In some cases, hundreds of people applying for just one opening. So employers really have their pick as to who they select. And you might be well qualified for the job, be an excellent fit for it, really want the job, but you're competing with tens, if not hundreds, of people for that one job. And that's really what's going on. Because when you have these very, very high levels of unemployment, you have a lot of people looking for a job. So employers, or the buyers of that labor, They have two advantages. They can select what they consider the best person, and they also can really dictate more or less what they pay them. Now, that doesn't last forever, because when you're in boom times, you might have be in a situation where you have very low unemployment rates, where you only have few applicants because people like to keep their jobs. But that's not the situation we're in today. Really, since this recession started, it's basically a buyer's market. Where I mean by buyer, an employer has the pick of the litter. He can pick anyone he wants that really... He might have a dozen things that he wants you to be able to do, requirements. You've seen them. I've been looking for a job. You know, some people will list about 10, 20. I've seen even longer lists. You got to have this capability. When you really, if you look through it, there, I always, on any job, there are about three or four, maybe even as many as six key talents or abilities that you need to have and what an employer is looking for. Then you have a lot of, has all the six. And when you're in this type of market, they can specify more things that are not really essential for the job. They're nice to have. It's like a car. You like the car, but there are a lot of options. Well, this is the same thing with an employer. I have certain key must-have requirements, and then I have another list of experiences either on the job or skills that you'd like to see your employee have. And I will say this, communication skills, both verbal and written, are very, very important. So you might really have the technical ability to do a job, but more and more employers are looking for people that could train other people, which means you have to have communication skills, language skills. And that includes reading, writing, and expressing yourself verbally and be able to listen. So communication skills on almost every job I see, now I'm looking for certain things. I'm primarily looking for a job in radio, so I obviously have to have communication skills. And I need to say this for people that have never seen a radio show being presented. I don't have a script. I'm not reading anything. Now, I did pick out, since this is a talk radio show that's news-driven, I provide my commentary and opinions of events that are happening in the real world. I do select certain stories, if you will, or news events that I think are important, that I want to express my views, my opinions, give you my commentary about, including the job situation. But getting back to on track, employers have literally dozens of people for every position they're hiring for. But what people are finding today when they go for a job, many employers are not hiring permanent employees. They're just not. And why not? Well, there's something called Obamacare that's supposedly going to start for individuals in October. And they just announced a delay in it for large companies. You probably heard that they're delaying it not for 2014, but to start in 2015 for large employers. But for the individual mandate, where you don't have coverage, and let's say you work for a small business, you're going to need to get medical insurance. It's required. Now, I'm totally against Obamacare. I'd be the first one to recommend you need good health insurance. I'm not against having good health insurance. But you should say, just like you buy your own food, your own car, your own stereo, your own clothes, guess what? Go out in the marketplace and buy your own health insurance. I used to sell group health insurance as well as individual insurance. And I didn't have, insurance was somewhat of a sideline for me. But I was a financial planner, and I would handle both investments as well as insurance. And I was knowledgeable in both areas. And most of my clients were small business owners. So I have a lot of experience with small business owners. And one of the first things a small business will do once it's in a position to do it, namely been around a while and are making money, and they want to retain employees, good employees that they hire, one of literally the first things that they buy is group health insurance. Now, why? If you're a small business owner, you need it at least for yourself and probably for your family. And I need to emphasize that. That's almost the first thing in terms of employee benefits that small companies will do. And it's a smart thing to do. Now, I'll be the first to say that some employers, they just want something. Other employers, they want the best that they can afford. Affordability is the key issue. By far, affordability is the key issue because businesses, especially when they're new, it usually takes months, if not years, and many years, to become successful because you're going to make mistakes. You might have a great idea, but it takes time to build up a client base and where you have a cash flow that you can provide all your employees good health insurance. And I'll add, after they've done that, what they typically will do is provide a retirement plan where people can put aside some of their money every month to go into retirement. And if the company is successful, they will match it to a certain extent. The point I'm trying to make is most employers, to remain competitive, know they need to provide not only a good wage or good salary, they also need to have a good employee benefit package. And the two key items there are health insurance and a retirement plan. And many times that's a 401k plan. Now, this is not a show about investments or insurance, but I need to get that across, because most small business struggle in their early years. And as they get successful, then they will add more and more benefits. But they have to really be good stewards of their resources. It's not that they're trying to screw the employee out of having that. I've listened to some employees complain, well, we don't have health insurance. And usually the reason why they don't have health insurance is the business does not have the cash flow to support it. Because even when I was in the business, and this is many, many years ago, health insurance is expensive. And what invariably happens, they shop it. I've lost clients because someone will walk in and show them a plan that's maybe just a few dollars cheaper. And there's some businesses that they'll bite on that. Now, I always emphasized when I was in the business, you get what you pay for. And I would ask the clients, what do you want? Do you want a really good plan from a reputable company that pays its benefits? Yeah. Can you afford it? I would always recommend a higher deductible. See, at one time, $100. Ooh, $100 deductible. That seems high. No, what happened is, over time, it went to $500, to $1,000, to some cases, and $2,000. Now, I'm getting into this because you probably heard the problems they're having with Obamacare. And the real problem they're finding out is people are simply not going to want to sign up for this. You see, if you're an individual and your employer doesn't provide it because he's small, he's just starting out, you will have to do this in October, have to go to an exchange, and in some states they're not even set up yet, and buy a health insurance plan. The real fear and concern in the White House, as well as in the Democratic Party, is that many, 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 and I mean millions of Americans will not buy it. And why won't they buy it? In many cases, they can't afford it, but they're young. See, I've said this on this show at least several times, that really the thrust of Obamacare, what it's really all about is forcing young people to buy insurance, health insurance, force them to do it through government coercion. Because I know, the insurance company knows, and so does the government know, that young people are usually healthy. You know, occasionally you'll get a claim, but they're usually not large. Most of, and this is for everybody, usually your largest claims or benefits that you'll get from health insurance is in the last year and really in the last 6 months of your life. The problem is you don't know when that year is going to be, but it's usually when you're older. When I mean older, in your 60s, in your 70s, and your 80s. Because that's where you start to see more and more heart attacks, more and more strokes, more and more cancer. So it's usually the last year, and more precisely the last 6 months, where not only do you need good health insurance, but where you're going to have your largest and biggest claims. You're going to need operations that are expensive. You're going to have long hospital stays. Conversely, if you're a young student, for example, at Richland College, with the possible exception of a serious automobile accident, you will probably have very, very few medical bills. Yeah, it's always a good idea to have an annual physical, and you might break a leg or cut yourself requiring some stitches, but generally, when you're young, in your 20s, really going into your 30s, your medical expenses are not going to be very large. You know, usually less than $1,000, in most cases, only a couple of hundred. Now, we're talking medical insurance now. Now, people still need dental, and that's not the case. I really want to zero in on the medical. Now, why am I getting into this? And why do we have such high unemployment, persistently high unemployment rates with tens of millions of people unemployed? If you're a business owner, you need to know fairly precisely what your cost of doing business is. And one of your major costs of doing business is health insurance. And if you're a small business owner, you're sitting there not knowing what it's going to be. Because prior to Obamacare, what employers would do or businesses would do is compete it. They would go to someone like myself, and I would take a census or a list of their employees, what their date of births are. I need to know their age, their sex, whether or not they need family coverage, how many children. I would take that information, and I would go to several companies and get proposals for them, and then I would present it. And they usually would go with me and select one of the carriers. I tend to offer them good carriers. I stayed away from the people. See, unfortunately, like in any industry, you're going to have some bad apples. And what I mean bad apples, there's some insurance companies, yeah, they'll pay the small stuff. But if you have a serious, you have a big medical bill where you, let's say, needed an operation, stayed in the hospital, that's when you find out whether or not you have a good carrier that's going to pay the bills. Now, most insurance, the overwhelming majority of insurance companies will pay the bills, but you do have a few companies out there that don't, that their business model is we'll pay for the small stuff, but when there's a big bill, we're either going to delay, 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 and after they play that game, when you come up for renewal, usually these policies or health insurance was renewable annually, they would really bump the premiums. And what invariably happened is the business owner, after this experience, he doesn't like employees complaining to him about the coverage, will switch to another carrier. I stayed away from those companies and tried to get them what I consider one of the most reputable and best companies around. And there's several of them. There's not just one. There's several. And I would show them that, and they usually went with them. But I will also say that when the annual premium renewal rates went up, occasionally I would lose a client, because what invariably happens is there are other people knocking on the door or calling them, and business owners trying to save some money will give them a shot. So it's competition, folks, and I'm all for competition. And you never like to lose a client. But invariably you will, because you can service them to death. You can be nice to them, send them cards, newsletters. But he's the primary focus of a business owner is to make sure his doors are open. Cash is king. They have to manage their cash flow. And the point I'm trying to make is you need a certain degree of certainty as to what the cost of doing business is, both in terms of salaries, wages, supplies, materials, whatever type business you're in. The enemy, or the one thing that business owners cannot stand, that drives them crazy, is uncertainty. Now, up until fairly recently, we had uncertainty as to what the tax rates were. We no longer have that, at least for the time being. But the big uncertainty out there today is the cost of health care. And the problem is Obamacare will be community rated, point one. And point two, the insurance companies cannot turn down anyone with a prior condition. And because of that, a community rated plan is the most expensive insurance out there. Let me make one point. Individual coverage, if you were to, as an individual, go out in the marketplace and buy it. At one time, you had many, many carriers that were offering that. There are very few today. But individual coverage was individually underwritten, which means they asked you questions, just like if you were to buy a life insurance policy, or for that matter, an auto policy. They asked certain questions. They wanted to know, have you had a heart attack lately? Have you had cancer? Things like that. Do you have a drug problem? And depending on your answers, and they would ask questions on various medical conditions, they either would reject you outright. We don't want to, we'd like your business, but you're a high risk. Or they would have to rate it, which means you would have to pay more than the regular price. Now, that's with individually underwritten health insurance. Some people have that. And I would recommend it, especially if you're self-employed, to have that, if you can find a good carrier. Many, many have left the business, starting in the Clinton administration when we had sort of the first round of this that thankfully failed. Most of your health insurance today is group coverage, where insurance company is either offering insurance to a business as a group or is administering a plan. So what most businesses would do is to go out and get bids, if you will, and then make a decision, again, based on the quality of the company, the quality of the plan. And I'm spending too much time on this. The point I'm trying to make is there's a lot of uncertainty. I don't know how much my employees are going to cost me. And when you have uncertainty, what happens? People hold off making decisions. They delay the hiring decision. That's why I'm trying to relate this to the unemployment situation, where you have increasing uncertainty and high levels of uncertainty in the business environment. You get a situation where we've had unemployment rates over 7.5, 8, 9, and one month we hit 10%. Full employment, you'll get, or near full employment rates, you'll get, again, a range of estimates from economists, but most would say between 3 and 4%. We're more than double that today. And we've been more than double that since 2008. In essence, during the entire Obama administration, both his first and now 6 months of his second, we've had very, very, very high unemployment rates. Has there been improvements? Yes, there have. First one to say it. But we went into a recession where we lost 8.6 million jobs, and we still need an additional 2.5 million just to get back to the previous peak in November. That's 6 years. We're going on 6 years, November of 2007. And that's before you even consider all the new entrants, between 7 and 8 million. Because what happened? Every month you have people trying to get their first job. And it's primarily young people, students, high school students, as well as college students. Sometimes it's when they're going through high school or going through college, they work part-time, or when they graduate from high school or college, they're looking for their first full-time job. And that's the problem today. Young people are finding it very, very difficult to find their first full-time job. You see, what's happened, and in the last month's report is showing this, yeah, there were about 360,000 people more employed that were employed part-time. Why? We're in the summer. What happens in the summer? People go on vacation. Or if they don't go on vacation, they might eat out. Most of the hiring is temporary, part-time, less than 30 hours. In many cases, less than 20 hours. And that's mainly in the hospitality industry. Those are restaurants, bars, hotels. Those are the jobs. Can you pay a mortgage with it? Maybe, maybe not. Most people that go for those, there's some that are looking strictly for part-time. Be the first one to say it. But most people, the only reason they're taking those jobs is they cannot find a permanent full-time job. They cannot do it. Now, what's even worse is we've lost last month 240,000. I'm giving you round numbers here. 240,000 permanent jobs. Permanent jobs. So this is not a good jobs report at all. Because, again, you need to be, what would impress me is if we had 12 to 24 months of 300,000 jobs or more. Now, why 300,000? Again, you got to about half of that, depending on who you listen to, between 130,000 to 150,000 is just to take care of new entrants to the labor force, to take care of the population growth. In addition to that, to reduce the unemployment rate by a tenth, you need approximately 150 to 160,000 jobs. So if you add the two numbers, the rule of thumb is you need around 300,000 new jobs to be created to reduce that unemployment rate by a tenth. Now, what I pay attention to is the U6 rate, which is the total unemployment rate that also includes people that are working part-time but are really looking for full-time jobs, as well as the so-called discouraged workers. And I have several videos on this that cover it, but let me kind of summarize. Let's say you're sitting at home, you've been looking for a job now for a year or two. And guess what? This rarely happens, but every month the Department of Labor is going out there and they're calling on approximately 60,000 households, and they're going to ask you, and you know, you either they come to your door or you answer the telephone, and they're going to ask you several. They identify themselves. They're going to ask you several questions. Are you employed? No, I'm unemployed. Okay. How long have you been unemployed? They'll ask you several questions. But one of the questions they're going to be asking you is, have you looked for a job in the last 4 weeks? 4 weeks. And what happens is people are honest. They say, listen, I've been looking for a year. I've sent hundreds of resumes out, but I got so discouraged. I'm running low on my money. I couldn't afford to send out more resumes, and I don't have the money for the gas. I didn't fill out any applications. So even though I'm unemployed, I'm ready and willing to work. You got a job? Could I work for the Department of Labor? But I really didn't go out and apply for a job or send a resume out or fill out an application. Well, you're not considered part of the labor. The category they put you in is discouraged worker. You're either employed, which could be part-time or full-time, unemployed, you're ready, willing, able to work, and in the last 4 weeks you've actually applied for a job, then you're unemployed. But if you haven't looked in the last 4 weeks, then you're considered a discouraged worker. Now, why did the Department of Labor do this, you know, under the Clinton administration and then in the Department of Labor under him. They wanted to get the unemployment number down so it didn't look so bad. So they said, let's exclude from the unemployment statistics those discouraged workers. Now, the man on the street, you and me, would say, he's unemployed. He needs a job, wants a job, is ready, willing, to able to work. But the department, well, that might be true, but he did not look for a job in the last 4 weeks, so we don't count him. You see the game they're playing? That's why you got to be very, very careful with government statistics. They will spin this, which is another word, as far as I'm concerned, mislead you as to how good or bad the situation is. It gets even worse. They also, even U6 includes those discouraged workers, and that number went up 0.5%, a big jump from 13.8% to 14.3%, which is quite high. However, the comparable number from prior to 1994 included not only short-term discouraged, it included all unemployed. So if you had not looked for a job for a year because you look, and can't find it, you were still considered unemployed. You're ready, willing to work, but you can't find a job. The long-term discouraged worker, in other words, if you have not looked for a job for a year or more, you're considered long-term discouraged workers. Those are excluded from the U6 number. Prior to 1994, we had 7 unemployment rates. And the point I'm trying to make, that the comparable number today, when you consider the total unemployed people in America, is somewhere between 22 and 23%. It's fluctuating. It's actually going up. And I give you a chart on that from Shadow Statistics at the near the very top. It shows those the U3 number, which is the official unemployment rate, the U6 number, which is the total unemployment rate, and then the comparable number prior to 1994. They call it the shadow statistics. That's the blue line. And you can see it's heading towards 25%. So the situation, the employment situation, is not good, especially if you happen to be young, a teenager, or someone in the 20s looking for your first job. That's why you have many, many college graduates out there that either do not have a job, or if they do have a job, they're waiting. They're a bartender or waiter or waitress in a restaurant. They're employed part-time, temporarily part-time, in a job where they didn't need a college degree. You frankly don't need a high school degree. And that's the problem. And if you happen to be black or Hispanic, it's even worse. You know, the unemployment rate for teenagers has been over 20% since President Obama has been in office. Now, the unemployment rate for teenagers, 16 to 19-year-olds, has always been high. And I'm scrolling down to see whether I did put it on. In June, for 16 to 19 years, teenagers, the unemployment rate was 24%. It's usually somewhere between 10 and 15. And I have a chart that shows you the numbers. But I'm trying to look. When did it first go in the 20%? The first month we had teenage unemployment rate was in, it definitely in 2008. I'm trying to eyeball. It was November of 2008, the teenage unemployment hit 20.3%. It's been in the 20% range since then. And that's quite high, even for teenagers. And even recognizing they've always had a higher unemployment rate compared to the average unemployment rate. That's awful, folks. That's awful. Because you want people to start a career. You want people to have a good work ethic. And what's happening, and this has happened in Europe, and now it's coming to the United States, where we're having more and more young people literally cannot find a job. Or if they can find a job, it's part-time and it's low-paying. And if it's part-time, you don't have health insurance. You don't have a retirement plan. You have very little job security, and there are a lot of people that can use that job. And you have a lot of illegal aliens that want that job. And I'm going to touch on it just a little, relate that to the illegal alien situation. I've been listening to people. Now, let me state my position. We have immigration laws on the books. And the majority of Americans, including me, all we want is those immigration laws enforced. Let me say that. We want the immigration laws enforced. And I always emphasize at the very beginning of a discussion on immigration, you have to distinguish between legal immigration and illegal immigration. I'm all in favor of controlled and limited legal immigration. We are, all countries are nations of immigrants. But the United States, above all countries, has welcomed immigrants into the United States. We have a long history of that. And I favor that, encourage that. But it has to be limited. It has to be controlled. Procedures are in place. If you're from another country, you can apply. And guess what? You're going to get on a long waiting list. That's just the reality. The United States today has a population of approximately 316 million. The population of the world is over 7 billion. There are literally tens, if not hundreds, of millions of people from all over the world that would like to be U.S. citizens. But only a small fraction of that will ever become American citizens. The average, for over 200 years, the average number of people from abroad that would enter the United States, on average, remember this is 1770 to 1970, the average, the long-term average, was approximately 250,000. 250,000. Yes, there were years when they were much higher, and there were years when they were lower. But the average was 250,000. Since 2000, and actually a little bit earlier, the United States, and I'm not in favor of this, and most American citizens are not in favor of this, but have been allowing over a million people to immigrate into the United States. Four times the average. And you need to understand that. That's a lot of people. A lot of people. And I'm talking legal immigration. I don't agree with the million. And I've said this on previous shows. I think the number of legal immigrants in the United States should be tied to the unemployment rate, the U3 unemployment rate. It should fluctuate where it can be high, let's say 500,000, if we're at or near full employment. In other words, if we had a unemployment rate of between 2-3%, I could see where we would be short workers, and up to 500,000 people could come in. Conversely, where we have unemployment rates above 7%, which is the current situation, and in the last 5 years, it's been over 8%, over 9%. The majority of the time, it's been over 9%. And you can see the numbers. I have them. Go to prankpops.wordpress.com on the very first segment, which is segment zero, when I'm discussing the unemployment situation. You can go there and see a lot of information about, for example, how the average weeks unemployed is now 35.6 weeks. In 2000, it was 13 weeks. You see, your unemployment benefits until not too long ago were 26 weeks. Why? Because most people were not unemployed 26 weeks. They got out and looked for a job and found a job. But starting, and I have all the statistics there, and you can look at the numbers, and they go up and down. But now it's over 30. It's been over 30 weeks since 2010. It's been over 20 weeks since right around 2009. And the numbers are there.
See, what's happened is what Congress has done to really, they've thrown money at the problem in terms of extending unemployment benefits. And that's both Democrats and Republicans. And I don't want to sound hard-hearted here, but I'm going to give you some tough love. It never should have happened. They should have left it at 26 weeks. Why? Because if you know your unemployment benefits run out in 26 weeks, you are going to be pounding the pavement, knocking on doors, trying to find a job. But when you give people nearly 2 years of unemployment to find a job, guess what happens? They will take it. Now, I think foolishly, because you're starting on that road to become increasingly more dependent upon the federal government. Instead of going out there and trying to find a good job, working hard, and building a career and raising a family, instead you become wards of the state. You become dependent upon the federal government. And that's what happens. The average number of weeks unemployed right now, their people are much higher than this, and there's some that lower, but the average is 35.6 weeks. And if you look at the new entrants, just for June, remember, those are people entering the labor market for their first time, 1,259,000. That's a lot of people looking for their first-time job. Now, what you should take away from that jobs report is, yes, employment of temporary part-time jobs is up, which you would have expected anyway during the summer, because that's when a lot of people go on vacation and they're traveling and they have to stay in motels, hotels, and you have restaurants and bars that cater to people on their vacation. It's seasonal employment. And guess what? In September or some cases October, what happens? Those people get laid off. So I would expect, and that's happened, we've had an increase of part-time employment. Conversely, we've had fewer permanent jobs, approximately 240,000 less in June than the previous month. Now, all this information is available at the Department of Labor. I also have a video. Peter Schiff, who's an investment manager, really did a very good analysis of the jobs report. And that's the very first video I have there, and I recommend you listen to it. Now, some of it will be repeating what I say, but the reason I show you this, some people have trouble with numbers and like to, you know, stop, listen, and maybe go back. So you can't do that with a broadcast. However, I do give you the video on it, and right under that, you have an economist, Williams, that puts out these shadow statistics, the chart I give you at the very top, and he discusses this. I'm not making this up, folks. Imagine if you heard in the news that the unemployment rate was not 7.6%, but the comparable number to years ago, prior to 1994, it's 23%. 23%. Am I waking you up? The United States economy is stagnating. We have a massive unemployment problem, largely brought on by the Keynesian economic policies of both the federal government and the Federal Reserve through their printing or creating of what I call digital money. Now, I don't have time for this show because I have two other segments that I'm going to get into. And I usually give you a high-level review, but this time I really wanted to zero in on the unemployment or the job situation, because I know that there are students on this campus as well as staff members on this campus that have children and relatives that are looking for jobs and can't find them. And it's not getting any better. It's actually getting worse. You see, what's going to happen, and there's a video right under that that discusses the both the labor participation rate and discouraged workers, you need to understand the concept of discouraged workers. That's a category that the Department of Labor uses to not count you. And the way you get in that category, if you have not looked for a job for the last four weeks, you are not considered unemployed. So you're not in those unemployment rate numbers. You are now a discouraged worker. And even if you look at U6, which is a much higher number, 14.3%, not quite double the U3 number, they don't count at all long-term discouraged workers. But the big picture number, in my mind, is we have an unemployment rate right around 23%. If you compare it with the unemployment rates prior to 1994. Ladies and gentlemen, that is horrendous. That is a scandal of the first magnitude, and that's what, as far as I'm concerned, the nation and the newscaster should be focusing on. Instead, we have these happy, I call them happy journalists. I want to be polite and not call them airheads. When this report comes out, this was a terrific jobs report. Unemployment remained constant at 7.6%, but 195,000 jobs were created. Isn't that terrific? And they went back and revised the previous months, and they upped it by 70,000 jobs. Isn't that terrific? And the White House is celebrating. Are you out of your minds? They put people on the air, major networks that spew this garbage. And it is garbage because they're not giving you the big. Did they ever? Like I said, what really annoys me? Okay, 7.6% unemployment means 11.7 million people are unemployed, and that's the low number. That's deliberately kept low so you won't have riots in the street, and it won't reflect badly on the president. They seldom, occasionally they'll mention it. You do have that U6 number, and oh, it went up 0.5%, a big jump. That's a big jump. They don't normally make that kind of move, but it did. Went from 13.8% to 14.3%. That's high, folks. It's been higher, but that's high. But that's not the comparable number to prior to 1994, which is right around 23%. They almost never talk about that, except when they're interviewing. Largely, I think Mr. Williams does an excellent job in the shadow statistics. He's an economist. He's been doing this for years. Most professional investors, the best people in my mind to rely on are not the economists, but the people that have skin in the game. Namely, they're investing their money and other people's money. They want to know what the reality of the situation is. And they will be the first to tell you, you cannot trust government statistics. You cannot trust it. They're not saying do away with it, but you got to understand what's going on here and how politics has influenced these numbers. Believe me, the comparable number for a 14.3% rate is 22.2 million people seeking a full-time job. 22 million people seeking a full-time job. And if you go up to the 23% rate, which is really the comparable one, that's over 30 million people. That's over 10% of the population of the United States can't find a job. Yet what is being covered in the news this entire week, and I'm going to cover it in a segment towards the end of the show, the George Zimmerman trial. The George Zimmerman trial. I have not watched a minute of the George Zimmerman trial, but it's on TV. It's on the radio, and I'll give you a hint what my position is on this. This was a politically motivated trial. It never should have gone. He never should have been arrested, and he never should have had a stand trial. That's not my opinion. That's the police chief there. That's the lead investigator. And the FBI did an investigation and could not, basically said this was not racially motivated. Mr. Zimmerman gets along with blacks. And I need to tell you a little story. I'm jumping ahead a little, but I didn't want to forget it. If you listen to the show, you know for a short period of my employment situation, I was helping out someone that was trying to get a business off the ground.
and they sold surveillance cameras and these magnetic doors. So I would go out and sell those systems, and I would go out with a technician, the individual that would actually install the cameras. I was the business person, the sales rep, account executive, however you want to call it. But I always brought out where I could. Sometimes the technician is busy installing the cameras, and I'd go out on my own. And I could go out on my own, but where the technician was not working installing a system, I would take him out on the sales call to get his advice. Some are very simple, and I don't need them. But on complicated, large businesses, it's always good, and I had no trouble with this, to bring the technician or the installer, however you want to call them, that's the person that's going to physically have to install these cameras or doors. Good idea. I had no problem with it, and I'd always, if the person was available, I would definitely take him out. Now, that probably happened less than half the sales calls. But one day we had a number of businesses in South Dallas that wanted surveillance systems. But we were between calls going to lunch, and he said, you know, I'm from around this neighborhood, and we were driving past a church of all places, and he says, you see that street there? I said, yeah. We used to have gang fights there. Gang fights? Well, this gentleman was Hispanic. I said, well, who are you having fights with? I said, well, blacks. There were black gangs and Hispanic gangs. And we'd have fights. And fortunately, my family moved away from this neighborhood, Dallas, and moved to the rural area outside of Dallas to really save me, because I was on my way for some serious trouble, because these were serious gang fights. And he said, I ended up in the hospital. This gentleman, very nice guy, terrific guy, he did not like blacks. And I have no problem with Hispanics or blacks, but he did not like blacks. And he told me why. Because he was in a lot of gang fights where the blacks were beating the you-know-what out of them. And he said, I was very fortunate. I had a single mom that took me. We moved specifically out of this neighborhood to a rural suburban setting because she knew that if I continued living here and getting involved in this gang violence, I might not make it or I'd be arrested. Now, I'm telling you this story for one reason. Many Hispanics and many blacks hate each other. And that's just the reality. And that's not said on most newscasts, but that's the reality. Am I saying the majority? No, I'm not. Am I saying all? Definitely not. But that needs to be acknowledged. There is no love lost between either groups. And I will tell you, I have some black friends, and they deeply resent the illegal aliens that have jobs here. And they're not too crazy about the American citizens that are Hispanic. Is that all of them? No. Is that the majority of people? No. But there are people that have had an experience that has led them. It could be parents. It could be their school situation. Now, I'm bringing them up for the simple reason the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin situation, the initial suspicion of a lot of people that knew nothing about Zimmerman, that this was probably an Hispanic that didn't like or did not get along with Hispanics, with blacks. I have a surprise for you. That's not the case. And the reason why that's critical, and that's why the FBI investigated this, in a second-degree murder case, you have to show that person has an attitude or an antipathy towards a group, in this case, blacks. He doesn't like them. He hates them. He's out to get them. They couldn't show that. Why? Zimmerman has friends as well as a college instructor where he was taking a course that were black. And they got along. That wasn't the case. In other words, the stereotype didn't hold. Did not hold. Because I remember what the person I work with, the technician, said. When I was growing up, my teenage years,
at least early teenage years, I was a member of a gang, and we were fighting blacks. And I can remember, I don't live in this neighborhood anymore, but I saw our neighborhood change over a 20-year period. One day, and this is literally true, I was driving towards Central Expressway. It was probably less than a mile from Central Expressway on Park Lane, heading west. And there's a school, a brand new school that they built. And I could not believe what I was seeing on that corner. There were two gangs going at it. I mean, slugging each other. This was a gang. This is not a normal school fight. And this is a major thoroughfare. There must have been 30 to 40 people in two groups slugging it out in Dallas, Texas. Now, that was not by any stretch of the imagination a normal situation. Like I said, I've lived in that neighborhood over 20 years. I never saw anything like that at all. And guess what? It was blacks on blacks. It wasn't Hispanics versus blacks or blacks versus Hispanics. But I remembered that. You see, the problem you had, and they were young. They were teenagers. Like I said, I kept on driving, and I'm sure the cops were on their way. They had not arrived, by the way. And that's a fairly, the neighborhood I was in was well patrolled. And we had some crime, but it was not, I would not consider it in any stretch of the imagination a high crime area. The biggest crime there were occasional break-ins and stealing of vehicles, primarily trucks. I lived there for over 20 years, and I had three attempted break-ins. One, they got me when I was away, so they got some of my stuff. But it was not what I would consider high crime, moderate crime. But that's in Dallas, Texas, not too far from a major highway, a major shopping center, North Park Shopping Center. Now, I'm telling that story for a reason. One problem that young people have is they get into fights. Usually it's in high school, junior high, high school. And who knows why, but they get into fights. If you don't have parents telling their children and making it very, very clear, that is not acceptable. And it's not just the principal and teachers that need to be doing it. It needs to be the parents. You don't do that. You don't go up to a person and hit them. You see, the problem is teenagers get the impression, well, yeah, I can get into a fight, but really, the worst that can happen, they'll send me the principal and they might suspend me for a couple of days or a week. What they don't understand is that once you're out of school and you're not in a school environment, and if you attack a person by hitting him in the nose, knocking him down, and then proceeding to beat him, and that's exactly what Trayvon Martin did, and there's evidence to support that, eyewitness testimony in the trial saying that, and you have pictures evidencing that, Trayvon Martin and everyone says it's tragic. Yes, it's tragic. Because if the parents and his teachers and the principal made it crystal clear, you do not do this. Because if you do, you're committing a crime, a felony, battery. You're assaulting a person. That's what's technically called battery. And it is a felony. And yes, if you're a teenager, you might go to juvenile court. But if you're over 18, yes, if it's a first offense, you'll probably have probation. But the real tragedy is when someone young does that, and I put pictures in this segment on this. Initially, what the news media did is show pictures of Trayvon Martin when he was much younger. He had a baby face. Trayvon Martin was over 6 feet, 6.1 feet. He towered over George Zimmerman. He was big, similar to his dad, who's also big. And when you're young like that and attack someone on the street, you've committed a felony, a crime, and that person is perfectly entitled to defend themselves. And that's what George Zimmerman did. Because I've been in I've been in a couple of fights, mainly when I was in either junior high or high school. And I don't even remember why. And usually they were quickly broken up. But if you do that outside a school area, you'll be arrested, you'll be going to jail, and if you're lucky, you might get probation. In this case, unfortunately for Trayvon Martin, he's dead. And that's the tragedy. Because all Trayvon Martin had to do was run about a block to where he was temporarily staying with his father. Remember, he was visiting his father. That's all he had to do, and he would be alive today, and we would have never known his name. Never known his name. Or he could have turned around and said to George Zimmerman, I live here with my father. Why are you following me? Instead, he attacked, assaulted, punched Zimmerman in the nose, who fell to the ground, and then started to punch him in the face and shove his head into a cement sidewalk. That's aggravated battery. That's a felony, and you might not get probation. He made the unfortunate mistake of attacking someone that was armed, legally armed, legally armed. And fortunately for George Zimmerman, there was a witness to this. Not only does the physical evidence support Zimmerman's story, so does the witnesses. And so did the police investigation. Now, I'm going to come back to this in a minute. This is kind of a teaser. And like I said, I didn't watch that trial. I'm leaving it up to the jury in this case that has heard all the evidence. In other words, the six jurors, they're, I believe, all women. That, and remember, both the prosecution and the defense can always excuse people to serve on. They've agreed to this jury, is the point I'm trying to make. I don't favor either one. I think they were both making serious mistakes, and unfortunately, one individual is now dead, and another individual is running the real risk of spending some time in prison. But everything I've seen and heard, he never should have been arrested. And for going on 6 weeks, over 6 weeks, he wasn't, because you have to have probable cause. And ladies and gentlemen, self-defense is legitimate. And let me give you a little background. I live in an apartment complex. Well, I live on Forest Lane, near campus, you know, 5 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. There are literally dozens of apartment complexes and houses. There's a mixture of houses, homes, as well as apartment complexes. And many of these apartment complexes are huge. I live in one that has 500 apartments. There's one immediately across the street that has over 1,000 apartments. And there are apartment complexes on either side. You know, and on the corners, there are shopping, you know, strip malls. There's a, you know, I live within a couple of minutes of a grocery store, one of these dollar stores. I get my cleaning done, and that's one of the reasons why I took it. I'm near a gas station. I'm near a grocery store. Now, I don't have to shop there. I can go down, you know, 5 minutes away, there's a Walmart and a Kroger. The point I'm trying to get across, this is apartment complex after apartment complex is literally probably tens of thousands of apartments. And the entire neighborhood is very much, in terms of their ethnicity, they're blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians. It's a mixture. Now, the complex that I chose to live in, because I moved in a little over 6 months ago, is I wanted something real close to Richland College, but I wanted something that's affordable, given my budget, since I'm looking for a full-time job, near, you know, shopping where I could get groceries. And I wanted something that recently was refurbished, which this complex was. I'm not going to give the name, but it has 500 units, and it has surveillance cameras, and it has a security patrol. Sometimes they're there in both the days and the nights. Sometimes they're not. You can't really predict it. But they have surveillance cameras, and supposedly someone was looking at what's happening because they're all over the place. I didn't have any problem with it, but some people do. And the lighting is good. But it is predominantly, why it's a very much a mix in terms of the residents, the predominant race of the people in that complex are black. But there's still Hispanics, and there are also a lot of whites. It's mixed. And that's typical of a Dallas neighborhood. And it's not just, don't get the impression there's just apartments, because there's some very, very nice homes scattered on the side streets. Forest just seems to be where they built a lot of apartment complexes. And it goes for miles. I'm trying to paint a picture so you understand the situation. Now, because my complex is 500 units, and most of them surrounding it are fairly big, too, or bigger, it's well patrolled. But I walk in that complex to the mailbox and back. It's probably 2 to 3 city blocks at most. And I usually do it in the daytime, but occasionally I'll do it at night. Occasionally I might just pull in if I'm driving out. It's a big complex. If someone attacked me in that apartment complex, let me hit me over the head or push me, guess what? I'm going to defend myself. And I'm older, and you need to keep that in mind. And I don't know what they're up with. They might be trying to rob me. Maybe it's someone that just doesn't like whitey. I have no problem if they're white, Hispanic, black. I don't care. I'll tell you what I do care about. I don't like people making a lot of noise, okay? And I have had to complain to the management about a small barking door. The point I'm trying to make is George Zimmerman lived in a comparable apartment complex, and there's a map of it. We go to segment 2, and he was a volunteer, these crime watch, people that go around. They're not paid, but he volunteered to do that because they had some break-ins. And I can understand that. If you live in Dallas, you probably, any length of time, you probably will have an attempt to break in your house. Some will not be successful, some will be. So I'm glad, I would be glad if someone in my complex volunteered to do that. That's not the case in my situation. The property manager has actually gone out, and part of the rent that I'm paying is to pay for those security guards that patrol. You see, I remember one night I was coming back from Richland College. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And there's usually, depending on when you get, we have one of these gates that you have a card, you swipe, it'll either open or close. So I was just following another car in. Well, right at the gate, the security guard had parked his car. He had asked, the car in front of me went in. I was right behind him. He stopped me and said, "Well, who are you visiting?" And I politely said, "I live here," and pointed to the sticker. He was embarrassed. He didn't look on the windshield for the sticker. They have since gone to a badge that you put on your rear view mirror. I told him, "I live here," and pointed to it. He said, "Oh, sorry. Go ahead." That was the adult way, the reasonable way, the right way to handle it. I shouldn't blow up or get mad at him. He's just doing his job. And that's the way an adult would respond. You see, what Trayvon Martin should have done is either run home or walk home and go to his house, or turn around and ask, "Mr. Zimmerman, why are you following me?" If, assuming he was. And that's still somewhat of an open question. Because what George Zimmerman most likely would have said, "I'm the crime watch person for the neighborhood. Who are you? I live here. I've never seen you before. Who are you? What business do you have?" Remember, this is an apartment complex that has gates similar to the one I live in. Because if he had turned around and asked the question, then he should have proceeded on his way. And guess what? George Zimmerman would not be in court today, and Trayvon Martin would be alive. You see, the problem, ladies and gentlemen, is families are very important. You need a mom and a dad to raise children. You need a mom and dad to emphasize repeatedly. Practice, practice, practice. Repetition, repetition, repetition. You don't punch out someone, a stranger. That's a no-no. I don't care what you do in the schoolyard. Well, I do care, but a fight in the schoolyard is completely different than when you're outside that environment and someone doesn't know you. You don't turn around and punch them and then proceed to beat them. Because if you do, son or daughter, guess what? You run the serious risk of being, you will be arrested and may go to prison or jail. And apparently that was just not emphasized by Trayvon Martin's parents. I'm not criticizing the parents, by the way, because this is a problem with all parents with their children. They have to be instructed repeatedly what's right and what's wrong. And that's what the question is, what's right and what's wrong? Because if you go up to someone and punch them out and then proceed to beat them, that person is, I don't care who you are, has the right of self-defense. And unfortunately, this case, George Zimmerman feared for his life and feared that Trayvon Martin was going for his gun, pulled it out, and shot him. A tragedy. Should not have happened. And the question is not who started it. You know, some people said, well, Zimmerman shouldn't have followed him. No. If I see someone that is suspicious, that I've never seen in the neighborhood, and I'm the local crime watch person, I think it's legitimate. I don't want strangers breaking in the houses. And all Trayvon Martin had to do was walk home to his father's place where he's temporarily staying. That's one alternative. Either walk or run home if he were scared. And if he wasn't scared, then turn around and ask Zimmerman, why are you following me? Assuming he was following. That wasn't done. And see, the police of that city, the police chief, that's the conclusion he came to, as well as the chief investigator. They did not have probable cause to arrest him. You just can't arrest someone because you think he should be arrested. Who cares what you think? What does the evidence show? He was detained, ladies and gentlemen, rightfully detained, because a person was shot. But what happened? I'm the cop, and I see pictures of this. I have it on the site. He has a bloody broken nose, and he has bruises, several of them, on the back of his head when his head was slammed into the cement walk. Now, I'm not saying Zimmerman is innocent, nor am I saying I don't know what happened. But I do know what evidence has been brought to bear. In addition to evidence, what's brought to bear, we had a president of the United States from the White House saying that Trayvon Martin could be my son. In the military, that's called undue command influence. The president should never have said that. But we were in an election year, and President Obama needed all the black votes he could get, all of them. He already gets about 95% of them that go to vote. But he need as many black voters to go out. And see, what was real strange about this whole situation, it was over 6 weeks after this happened where the police did not arrest him because they didn't have the evidence to arrest him. It was self-defense as far as the police were concerned, as also as far as I'm concerned, tragic as it will be. And there are witnesses that saw this, one in particular, testified for the prosecution, made clear who was getting beat up, and it was Zimmerman. There's too much both witness and other evidence that supports George Zimmerman's side as opposed to Trayvon Martin's side, whatever that side is. He can't speak. Unfortunate. He had a number of choices, though. He could have run home. He could have walked home. He could have turned around and confronted Zimmerman, but instead he punched him out. He thought he was in the school playground. No, he wasn't. Just because he's in his neighborhood, you don't do that. Now, unfortunately, there are too many movies, too many television shows, and too many instances, live ones in the news, where people have, in essence, started fights. And at the bottom of this segment, I have a famous movie. As a matter of fact, it was starring Charlie Bronson. I think it's called Death Watch. And I put it in the segment, and I have a whole movie. There's an actual link to it, where he becomes a vigilante. He was tired of people raping, beating, killing, robbing people, and he decided to take justice in his own hands. He armed himself, and if anyone did anything to him, he shot him. Now, that's a crime. That's excessive force, but that should be required viewing. That's why you don't steal stuff or beat up stuff, because guess what? Someone would
come in and find you in their home, fear for their lives, and pull out a gun and shoot you. And guess what? They're entitled to do it. And you might say, that's excessive force. Uh-uh. Many times robbers can be bigger than you. They can be armed and you don't know it, and you're fearing for your life. You don't break into people's homes, because if you do, you run the serious risk of being shot. And if you attack someone, you run the serious risk of being wounded or killed. And unfortunately, that's what happened to Trayvon Martin. Now, I don't know what the jury is going to decide. And I have better things to do than to listen to this entire court case. Now, you can go to YouTube, and there are hours and hours and hours of testimony. But I was suspicious of this because it's highly unusual. A matter of fact, inappropriate for a president to express this view. And then the Department of Justice under Eric Holder sending Justice Department employees on the federal payroll to Florida to basically incite demonstrations and bringing Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson down. This is what I call race racketeering. If it weren't for the president and that being done, we have never would have heard of Trayvon Martin. And I'll tell you what's really scandal about this. Most violent crime on blacks is done by blacks. Over 90%. And blacks disproportionately. Blacks make about 12% of the population. About half of the homicides in the United States are done by blacks. And who do they kill? Primarily other blacks. That's the scandal. And Jesse Jackson, Barack Obama, where do they come from? Chicago, over five, which has become the homicide. It's a gun-free zone, the homicide capital of the United States. That's what we really should be talking about. And who is committing these murders? It's primarily black gang members on other black gang members or innocent civilians in black neighborhoods. That's what really should be talked about. But instead, what has the media been doing for the last year? I call it an electronic lynching of George Zimmerman, when the case should have never really gone to trial at all. The evidence was not there. You did not have probable cause. This is outside political influence in an election year to get out the black vote, because Whitey killed the black kid. Yeah, he killed him after he was punched out and in fear of his life. It's called self-defense. And maybe if his parents really had told and educated their own children not to go punching people, Trayvon Martin would be alive today. It's that simple. This was politicized. That's the scandal here, folks. Politicized. And I have a lot of information on homicide and crime statistics. And I'll make myself clear. I don't care. I don't care about this case, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't side with either one. I think they both made major mistakes here. One lost his life and the other runs the risk of going to jail. And even if he's fully acquitted, which I think he should be, because I think this is very much a media show trial and electronic lynching, and I think they're going to be very disappointed if he's acquitted of all charges, which I think he should be, because I think this is a clear-cut case of self-defense. He was entitled to carry that weapon. Trayvon Martin was not entitled to go punch someone out. Period. That's when the line was crossed. If you want to get to the who started it, Trayvon Martin started it. It doesn't matter if George Zimmerman was following. It absolutely does not matter if the police say stay in your truck. He lives in that neighborhood. He's three blocks away. He called the cops. Seemed to be. And the media, NBC, and I have clips of this, edited out the sound bites of the 911 call. Maybe you've forgotten about that, where George Zimmerman was asked by the police officer receiving the 911 dispatcher, could you please describe him? Is he black, white, or Hispanic? And George Zimmerman said, well, he looks black. And they cut that out it is made to appear, and this is a major news network did this, and unfortunately, many Americans get their news from the major news networks. That was despicable. And that's why I mean this has been a media circus, a media show trial, and an attempt to lynch somebody that, quite frankly, was exercising his right of self-defense. Because believe me, if someone is hit me in the face and knocked me to the ground and is beating me, I'm going to use anything in my power, a knife, a gun, my fist, to escape. And Trayvon made the mistake of picking on the one person that had a gun, that had called the cops. This was a politically motivated show trial by President Obama, the Justice Department, to rally the black American voters to come out and vote for him in November. Because if he didn't get involved, if the Justice Department didn't get involved, if Al Sharpton and the major news networks did not get involved, let me tell you, you never would have heard of the fact that George Zimmerman was not arrested. This case would have not have been on the news, would have not have been on the news at all. And the only reason I'm bringing it up, we have tens of millions of unemployed Americans, mainly young people, blacks, Hispanics, whites, Asians, that are unemployed today. Millions of them. And what are we talking about? The George Zimmerman trial. Give me a break. I've just got a signal to wrap it up. I'm not going to have time to get into my second segment one on the tragedy in Canada. I'll try to touch upon it next week. But I want to put in perspective. I learned about this tragedy Saturday afternoon. It occurred early Saturday morning, about 1 o'clock. The current estimates, about 50 people or more have been killed in this train wreck. 50 people. I heard very, very little coverage of this on the news. And really, it was for a day. We've heard very little about this since. Why am I even bringing it up? Everyone that looks into this knows that it's safer to transport oil over pipelines. It's a lot cheaper and it's a lot safer to do that. Yet we've had a president of the United States that's resisting that. Why? Because one of his major contributors is Warren Buffett, who owns stock in a railroad that's one of the primary beneficiaries of transporting oil from the Bakken fields down to where the refineries are in Texas. And that was the oil in those tankers that had exploded came from those fields. They were put on trains. And I have videos showing that. There are literally over 30,000 cars that are using trains to get the oil to wherever they need to. We need pipelines. We need jobs. The pipeline would be, we need more refineries, we need more jobs, and guess what? It would have saved those 50 people that were killed or more in that small town of 6,000 would be alive today if we had not transported that oil on the railroad tanks. Nothing against railroads, but they're significant. They cost more, and they're less safe than using a pipeline. And again, it's politics. I didn't have time to get into it, but I need to wrap up the show. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening. I hope it's been informative, and probably by next Friday we'll have a verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. And like I said, I don't really care how it goes, other than from what I've read and heard. And again, I really have not paid much attention to this. He should be acquitted of all charges. It was strictly, as far as I'm concerned, a situation of self-defense. Thank you and have a good weekend. And I'll be back next Friday from 3 to 5. Now back to the music.